I've had a Mini EV for 2 years now. Would you like to hear my thoughts about it?
Go on then.
Okay. So it's a battery EV, a BEV, as opposed to a plug-in hybrid, PHEV. So that's what type of car it is. It's just got a battery. There's no petrol engine. It relies on the battery for powering the thing. It's a pretty black colour with two doors. It's a 2021 model when I bought it, but the design is a 2019 design Mini. Its official name is BMW Mini Cooper Level 3, where there's a Level 1, 2 and 3, which are the trim levels with the toys that you get and what type of interior and that kind of stuff. Two sunroofs. The sunroof opens, the back one doesn't. Split rear seats, leather interior. It's got a 30 kilowatt hour battery, and the charging plug is what's called CCS, combined charging system, a combo thing that does AC and DC charging. So pretty standard in the UK. It's got an onboard BMW computer software thing with a sat nav and a few apps like weather, DAB radio, Apple CarPlay, but no Android Auto. And it's got a little handy phone cubby in the armrest, which does induction charging. So you just chuck your phone in there and it induction charges and connects wirelessly to the car, which is really quite nice. It's got aircon, all with physical controls. You don't have to use the display in order to control the interior of the car or anything like that. And speaking of displays, it's actually got three displays. There's one in the middle, one in the front of the driver, and then there's a little head-up display that's also in front of the driver that only the driver can see, that's got like your speed, and if you use the internal sat nav, it shows directions on there as well, which is really quite handy.
You mentioned many things that I'm interested in knowing more about there.
We won't have time to cover all of them, of course.
No, the last one is head-up display,
yes.
Like a fighter pilot on the windscreen.
No, it's projected onto a small piece of frosted glass that pops up when you start the car, and it's a bit further away than the dashboard, and it's to reduce eye strain because you're not having to keep toggling your eye focus from out in the car to inside the car to the dashboard, because you could just look down slightly and your eyes don't have to focus so far because it feels like it's further away, if that makes sense.
Understood. And the thing I would love to know, because I know nothing about EVs, is what sort of range do you get on it?
We'll get to that.
Okay.
So the reason I bought this car was because I've had a ton of cars over the years. I'm old. I've had lots of cars. I've had some secondhand, some hand-me-downs, but I've never actually had a brand new car for me, for my pleasure. And I do enjoy driving, less commuting, but I do enjoy driving. And now that the kids are grown up, I don't really need a chunky car to carry around a pram and, you know, nappies and all that kind of stuff. We've done all that, and that's in the past, and the kids are all grown up. So I can get away with having a two-door car, which is what it is. I test drove the Nissan Leaf, the Tesla, a Citroen C4. The Tesla was too expensive, the Citroen was too big, and the Leaf was too ugly. And the Mini was the last one I test drove. And the sales guy, when I got in it, he didn't put any effort to sell the car to me at all. He just said, you'll buy this car once you have a drive of it. And I don't know whether that was a psychological manipulation on his part, but I did. As soon as I drove it, I was like, yeah, okay, yeah, this is better than all the other ones I've driven. I'll buy this. So that was why I bought it and what I've had. And I've had it for 2 years now. My first impressions when I got it, it's got like this retro styling that's a harks back to the old Mini with the big round central circle where the Speedo used to be. And there's inside that is a little rectangular display. There's lots of actual tactile buttons. They feel like the kind of toggle switches you get on airplanes or helicopters. I quite like that feel to them. I don't like just having a display in a car. It's very futuristic, but I actually quite like grabbing hold of a temperature gauge and turning it, or pressing a button to flick the seat, heated seats on or something like that. I really like that. It's a very comfortable car to sit in and drive, despite me being almost 6 foot tall and on the wide side. I know it's a bit of a cliche, but it drives like a go-kart. It's 0 to 60 in about 6 seconds, and it's restricted to 93 miles an hour top speed, allegedly, apparently. It is tremendous fun to drive, and I absolutely love it. It's just great. I absolutely love the car.
I also got one of these newfangled EVs about a year ago now, and I actually got one of the ones that you mentioned, I got the Citroen EC4, which, you're right, it is quite big, but it's also tremendous fun to drive.
Yes.
It has three modes. It has an eco mode, a normal mode, and a sport mode. And if you put your foot down from a standing start in sport mode, it feels like it's trying to pull the tires off the wheels. It really can go. For a car of its size, my previous car was very small and had a diesel engine, and it's a completely different world.
It's quite a shift, isn't it?
So I'm just catching up on all the lingo here. If, Mark, you have an EV car, that means it's battery only, yes, like Alan's Mini.
Yes.
No hybrid nonsense.
Yep.
Yes.
So how do you both go about charging your cars?
So that is a very good question. I had a charger fitted to the house. When I ordered the car, there was a discount where I could get a charger and I could pick one of a number of chargers. And I got one made by a company called Ohme, O-H-M-E, which I've just realized is an anagram of the word home. And it's attached to the outside of the front of our house. We're fortunate enough to have a driveway on the front of the house. And I back the car onto the driveway and just plug the cable into the car. And it has a system where it connects to my energy provider and determines when the cheapest electricity is throughout the day. And it will just charge it as and when. I don't have a schedule. The only thing I tell it is I want to leave the house at 7 a.m. and it makes sure that it's full by 7 a.m. So whatever it has to do that, it does it. And I don't care how, it just does it.
Yeah.
There's been very few occasions where I've got in the car and it hasn't been full, but that's usually because I've gone out the day before and completely emptied the battery and plugged it in and it hasn't had a chance to fill it overnight because it's not a super fast charger attached to the house,
right?
Which is fine. And that's rarely a problem. And I know that a lot of people bleat about, oh, well, you can't get very far, the battery's run out and all that. Well, I don't go very far. Like, my distance I travel every day is limited. So on a daily basis, it's perfectly fine. And I just charge it at home and I can do 2 or 3 days without charging it.
And I do exactly the same thing. I have a charger from exactly the same company.
Oh, really?
And I also have the same energy supplier. The slight difference with mine is that mine is just inside the garage. So I run the cable under the garage door.
Right. So you've both got Economy 7 for your cars is what you're explaining there.
Essentially, yes.
Kind of, yeah. They've got a special tariff for it. I have charged it away from the house. And I've talked about that in previous episodes where I talked about getting data from the car. It's a lot more often than I charge at home.
Right.
I mostly charge at home. The only times I tend to charge when away is if I go on a long journey. And my definition of a long journey is 100 miles or more. And that's an unusual thing. I don't tend to do that very often. Although it's fine because I'm actually the kind of person who quite likes breaking up a journey and having a coffee and a sit down. And if I can go to McDonald's and plug the car in at McDonald's and get a cheap cup of coffee, which is perfectly fine by me, then that's fine. Or go to a supermarket, and if they've got a charger at the supermarket, I'll do that. I'm not particularly fussy.
Yeah. I think my car's, because it's a bit bigger, it has a bigger battery, and therefore it's got a slightly longer range than yours. But I find that by the time I need to stop and charge it, especially given that I've got my family in the car, it's about the time we need a break anyway, and about the length of time that we need to have a break for is the amount of time you take to charge it if you're doing a big journey.
Yeah. One of the things I'm not a big fan of is the internal mapping software. It's BMW and it's rubbish. It's good enough to get you from A to B, but the user interface is shocking. And on 2 occasions, I relied on it to find me a charger, and twice in one day, it took me to wild random places. It took me to a farm that was just closed, and it was like, oh, here's the nearest charger. And the other time it took me to a hotel that didn't actually have a charger. And so that frustrated me immensely. And I get, you know, the people who hate EVs will say, well, that never happens with a petrol car. You go to a petrol station and everyone knows where petrol stations are and they sell petrol. Yeah. Okay. I get it. Move on. So in fact, that night when I visited 2 separate places and I was getting really low, I got to a few percent, I ended up finding a Tesla supercharger nearby and just used that. And so I had to install the Tesla app. So I've even used the dark side chargers as well as like all the others that there are. I've tried them all. And most of the time, they mostly work. And most of the time, they charge pretty quickly.
So I suffer quite badly with like battery anxiety on my phone. And this whole conversation is making me feel anxious. But I was delighted to hear that there's induction charging for your phone in the car.
Yeah.
Earlier on, you mentioned you've got air conditioning.
Yeah.
Are you selective about how you use things like air conditioning? And does that have like a noticeable impact on your range when you engage something like that?
So in general, no, I don't care. I'll put the blower on cold or hot, or put the hot seats on, and like I'll just use it like a normal car. The only time when I have done the whole hypermiling thing, where you put it in eco mode, like it's got two levels of eco mode. It's got a sport mode where it's a bit more responsive and, you know, it's got a bit more pep, and it turns all the LEDs inside red when it goes into sport mode, which is quite good fun. Mm. And then it's got an eco mode, which is a bit more conservative about how it delivers power. And then it's got this like super eco mode called Green Plus or something. And then it turns off all the fans and stuff. And there's stuff you just can't turn on. Heated seats you can't turn on. And I don't use that very often. The only time I have is when I've driven Sophie back to college. And interestingly, the journey to her place is around about 50% capacity of the battery. Huh. So I can get all the way to her college, drop her off, and then get all the way home and the battery's dead. But if I have a heavy right foot or I put the aircon on and everything, then it will go a bit faster. So I usually stop off at a motorway services on the way home to get a cup of tea or coffee, and then that's fine. But it is possible for me to do that, but I don't do it very often because I don't find that a pleasurable way to drive. Like, I know some people who are super frugal or super tight, whatever you want to call them, who absolutely want to put as few electrons in the motor as possible and keep as many in the battery as they can. I don't really care. I'll put my foot down and, you know, it uses a bit more. So what? Life's too short to do that. Other than the internal nav, I have no other real bad experiences with it. I had a couple of warranty things where it wouldn't charge and I sent it back to BMW and they gave me an i7 as a courtesy car, and I had a tire pop, and because it's so small, it doesn't have a spare tire in the boot. BMW just turned up with a van and the guy swapped the wheel for me for another one that he had in his van. It's been quite a pleasurable experience given it's my very first experience of having a brand new car. So, yeah, I love it. And I will talk about it incessantly with anyone who will listen. And I've written a long blog post that goes with this. So that'll be linked in the show notes.
The great migration has started, and I've begun moving all of my services from my old home server to my new home server.
Ooh, how exciting. Has it got that fresh server smell about it?
It smells a bit like burning dust.
Oh, no.
So my new server, which we discussed on the last episode, is now running and installed and all good at the operating system level. And I've started moving the things that I run on my own server over to it. And I've decided I wanted to do this in several stages because there's a few things which I think are going to be easy and a few things that I think are going to be tricky. And some of the things that I'm running, I need running all the time. So I don't really want much of an interruption. Things like, you know, my password vault and my Nextcloud server, which is always syncing stuff and so on and so forth. So the first stage that I wanted to go for, the way I run my services is I have each of them running on the server. Most of them have a web interface and expose themselves on some sort of port. And then I run Nginx as a web server to serve as a reverse proxy. And what that means is I don't have to ever enter any port numbers when I'm accessing something. I have just a regular web address, HTTPS subdomain or subdomain / something. And I won't go into the complete details of my DNS and port forwarding setup, but basically what that means is that each app can have its own address with a properly signed SSL certificate, so I can access everything over the public internet. It goes to my house over HTTPS, goes into Nginx securely, and then gets proxied to the actual application inside.
That's pretty straightforward to do, really, isn't it? It's just a simple bit of Nginx config and certbot, really.
Yes, exactly. So that's what I've been doing up until now. I've had Nginx and certbot installed with apt, I think, or certbot might have been installed with the snap. And when you run certbot, you tell it which web server you're using if it can't find it, and it can configure it for you. And you tell it which domain you're using. As long as that domain can reach the server, it can do all the config it needs to get itself verified and then make sure that you're using that certificate from then on. So one thing that I wanted to change a bit when I migrated to my new server is running more things containerized.
Ah.
Yes. So at work, I do a lot of stuff with Docker and Docker Compose, which means I am very comfortable with it and understand how it works. So I thought it would be good to, rather than the mishmash of apt and snaps and Docker containers running via various means, I'd try and do as much as I can in Docker Compose, and then maybe have a few other things on the side, which I'll get to in a future discussion. But what I wanted to do for this first step was just move Nginx to my new server in a Docker container.
Oh.
And have it doing all of the proxying to all of the stuff that's still running on my old server.
Oh, nice.
And that lets me do the bit of getting all of my subdomains and the port forwarding and all of the certificates sorted on the new server before I start actually migrating the back end of each service across.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any problem running Nginx as a reverse proxy inside of Docker?
No, actually.
Oh.
That worked perfectly well. I thought it was going to be tricky, because what I've done before is I've had it run as a reverse proxy to other Docker containers, which is very nice, because inside of Docker's own like private network, each container can refer to itself by the container name. So you don't have to keep track of what IP address everything is getting. You just tell Nginx,
nice.
You know, that's the Bitwarden container. It's called Bitwarden, proxy to Bitwarden. And it can just do that. But it also works perfectly fine if you're either going to something outside of Docker on the same machine, or if you're going to a completely different machine. It all just works. That wasn't a problem at all. The slightly trickier bit was certbot. So certbot, right, they recommend running as a snap. They also have a Docker image available. But in either case, if you're running your web server inside a container, it can't then do the auto configuration.
Why?
Because it doesn't know where the config files are going to be necessarily, because it depends where you put them.
Okay.
So what this meant was two things. Firstly, you have to put a couple of bits of your Nginx config in Docker volumes. That means that's a folder on your host, which is available inside your Nginx container. The two things that you need are the place where your certificates live. So this is, you know, each domain has a certificate which verifies that it's you and has your encryption key embedded in it. So certbot needs to put them somewhere, and then Nginx needs to be able to read them. So then you need to have them on a volume. The other thing that you need on a volume is the challenge directory. So when you run certbot, what it does is it creates a file essentially in a known location, which then their service can ping and say, is this actually on that domain? Do you really own that domain? Is certbot able to put something there so I know that I can verify that it's really you? So you also have to have somewhere that certbot can write to, that Nginx can have at that directory.
Right.
So set those up in Docker, then you have to do the Nginx config manually to say that /well-known/ whatever it's called, challenge something, is here, and put in the SSL config yourself, which actually isn't too much of a problem once you know, and you only have to do it once for each domain, because certbot sorts out as it rotates the certificates. It has a symlength which always points to the current one, so that's not too much of a bother.
And I'd imagine this is well documented somewhere.
It is.
I didn't have to do this when I did it outside of Docker.
Exactly.
But if you do it inside of Docker, that must be something that everybody, or a lot of people, want to do. So it must be well documented, right?
Yes. There's plenty of examples of this around, and
right.
in the documentation for containers, in the certbot documentation, they point you to ways of doing this. But it was a bit trickier than I would have liked, but now I've done it, I don't have to worry about it. And I did actually manage to get all of my stuff running. I pointed my domain at my new server once I had it all configured, and everything works. I've got a new front-end server with everything running on the old server for now.
Nice.
And next, I can look at migrating the services over.
Okay, so just for some clarity, this is a server running Ubuntu.
Yes.
And the specs of your server, it's one of these mini PCs, right? How much RAM has it got?
8 gig.
Yeah, so this is quite a tidy little system that you're going to be able to equip with a bunch of useful services for your home network.
Yes, I've already got several things running on the old server, and I should be able to migrate them all over and still have a bit of headroom for playing around, which is where I was getting stuck with the old server. It was starting to run out of oomph with its limited CPU, that if I wanted to do anything more than the stuff that was already running, it started to hamster got tired in its wheel.
I shall be interested to hear how your RAM consumption goes as you add more containers and services to this machine and what 8 gig can get you these days.
And I'll be interested to tell you.
Watch this space.
While I was setting up my new workstations, I decided to do away with swap files and swap partitions and get with the times. So I have moved to ZRAM swap.
So you still have swap of some description, but not as we know it.
Correct.
Also, do you mean ZRAM?
No, I don't.
Okay.
So I'm sure there's people that are listening to this thinking, oh, well done, Grandad, you finally caught up with, you know, ZRAM swap. But this is something I've seen around. It used to be called comp cache some time ago in the kernel. But how it works is it's a block device created in memory that is compressed using a number of the compression algorithms that exist in the kernel, so Z standard and LZO and LZ4 and a bunch of others. And it can present itself as a swap place. And if you do experience memory pressure, instead of pages being swapped out to either spinning Rust or your SSD, they are swapped out into compressed pages on this block device. And because it uses compression and it's in memory, it's very fast.
So when you say it's very fast, like, it was always the case that, you know, you don't want to swap to spinning Rust because that's many orders of magnitude slower than writing to RAM. And, you know, even writing to an SSD is some orders of magnitude slower than writing to chips close to on the motherboard, right?
Right.
Is the overhead of compressing and writing to this block device comparable to writing to an SSD, or is it ludicrously fast and you don't notice it?
In terms of committing the pages to the compressed memory area, it's as fast as the theoretical limits of SATA SSD. So you're talking about hundreds of megabytes a second. So very fast. However, the reading the pages back is in the order of thousands of megabytes per second. So it's considerably quicker than using an SSD for swap. And the reason I did this is I didn't want a swap partition or a swap file taking up gigabytes of space on what is, generally speaking, a limited commodity of disk availability on your SSD.
This might be the stupidest question in the world, but if your problem is that you're going to have to swap out because you don't have enough RAM, why not just compress all of the RAM?
You can do that as well. There is another facility called ZRAM, just ZRAM. What I'm talking about here is ZRAM swap.
Right.
And the reason that I haven't looked at that is because I just haven't looked at it. This looks like the way that the sort of the leading edge distros are going. So I think Fedora have made the move already. No, I don't think. I know Fedora have made the move. This is in their default configuration now.
So that's how swap is done in Fedora now, is just with this?
Yeah, for desktop.
Oh, that's really interesting.
And the principal reason for approaching it, as I understand it, is it was to get some desktop performance back so that when you do encounter memory pressure and swapping happens, it doesn't go to some crusty disk device or SSD.
But the downside is you've got less RAM.
Or not. So when you configure it, there's these days, the way that it's configured, there's a systemd helper called ZRAM generator. Which you can feed with some configuration and it will create this device or devices for you. And when the initial ZRAM block device is created, it doesn't pre-allocate from memory at all. So on this workstation here, I actually have quite a lot of RAM. I have 128 gigabytes. And the default configuration is to allow ZRAM swap to use up to half of your memory. So by default, I have a 64 gigabyte swap area, but none of it is allocated. So you can actually go way up to almost the full capacity of the onboard RAM before it starts to use these compressed swap pages. And some of these compression algorithms can compress up to like 4:1. So you get quite a lot of like utilization of this compressed area if you actually need to start using it.
Yeah, but you are a super outlier with 128 gig of RAM. The vast majority of people have 8.
Right.
And maybe less. And so they will be more likely to swap anyway, because applications are fat and memory is short, and they will want to swap. And so they probably, the systemd unit will allocate some space, and they will have less RAM.
Yeah.
As a result. That's the average use case.
But they will effectively have more RAM. So let's imagine you're 8 gigabytes, because I tested this with an 8 gig machine because I wanted to actually see how it worked in practice. So I had the 8 gigabytes and I allocated 2 gigabytes as compressed swap and used an algorithm that got me about 4:1 compression ratio. And whilst I was doing a build that I knew, as this is a large compile that I knew would in the 8 gig of RAM, when it gets to the swap level, it starts compressing, and instead of ooming, the build continued to run and completed, and the amount of RAM I was actually using was 12 gigabytes because of the way it was able to page in and out of this compressed page area. So you do sort of effectively get more RAM when you start to use these compressed pages.
No, I'm not allowing that. I'm not allowing more RAM. RAM is physical chips on the board.
Right.
You may have more virtual allocatable memory, but there, yeah. I'm not going to let you get away with saying more RAM. Sorry.
As far as the processes are concerned, it's able to continue to operate with.
It's a novel thing.
Yeah. And I've been very happy with it. I chose to use LZ4 compression on my main workstations, which doesn't have the most compression ratio, but it's very, very fast. So because I generally have enough RAM, I care more about the performance of when it needs to page in and out than actually the amount of compression that I get. And I've gone with the default of being able to use up to 50% of the RAM for compressed pages. And there is a couple of caveats, and that's that if you want to use Hibernate or Hybrid Sleep, so these are the system powers off when it goes into a deep sleep sort of power saving mode, the way that they work is they have to write the full contents of RAM to disk, and they obviously do not work with this compressed in-memory pages approach. So if you want to utilize Hibernate or Hybrid Sleep, you have to have on-disk swap, and you can't mix and match between ZRAM swap as like a principal target and a disk-based swap as like a backing store. There's currently no way to differentiate between the backing store of your swap. So I have now disabled in my configuration the machine from ever invoking Hibernate or Hybrid Sleep. It's just outright disabled. It's not a thing that can be accidentally invoked or turned on by automated services. So that's one consideration. Well, those are the considerations. But overall, it's been terrific and it works very well.